The Bloodstream Podcast is brought to you by Shire, and for that we say thank you, Shire. And thank you for listening to the Bloodstream Podcast. Welcome back. Welcome to 2019. I won't spend too much time with introductions. Natalie and I are going to do that in a moment, but I am just very excited to be back in one of these traditionally formatted episodes with my dear wife, Natalie. A couple quick announcements before we jump right into the pod here. We had a great year in 2018, and we intend on continuing to grow Bloodstream and the Bloodstream Network in 2019. You can help us by leaving Bloodstream a rating on iTunes. If you haven't already, they go a long way toward helping other people find the podcast. Five stars. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, and share Bloodstream on Facebook, Twitter. Tell people about it on Instagram. Send your friend an email. Help us spread the word. Also, if you check out our YouTube channel, which is the Blood Feed YouTube channel, you will find over 260 video resources that Believe Limited has created for the bleeding disorders community. So sometimes people ask me, you know, where can we find your stuff? Where can we find Stop the Bleeding? Where's that Teen Impact Awards show taking place? Hey, Hemophilia the Musical, I heard you did that in New York. Yes, we did. Where can we see video from that? If you go to YouTube and look for Blood Feed, you will find over 260 videos. It covers everything we do. You'll never run out of time. You'll run out of time. You won't run out of videos. There's a lot to check out. So check it out. And of course, stay in touch with us on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, at Bloodstream Info on Twitter. You can now find us on Instagram as well, where I think we are Bloodstream Info, Bloodstream Media, Bloodstream Pod, something like that. I don't know. I could look it up and re-record it, but you know, we like to keep it authentic. And you can always email us if you have suggestions for future episodes, feedback on something we covered, or if you'd like to submit an idea for a future share segment to be a share segment contributor, you can email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. And just one quick programming note, as Shire is now a part of Takeda, this is likely the last episode that you're going to hear us talking about Shire, and you may start seeing the Takeda logos in the episode promotional materials as opposed to the Shire logos. So I just wanted to give you that heads up that Shire is now part of Takeda, and you may start to see that reflected here on the Bloodstream Podcast, which I think Natalie might have a little bit of trouble adapting to, as you'll find out when we get to the remainder of the Shire shoutouts later in the podcast. Okay. Enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 32, January 21st, 2019. I'm Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, Clive Smith and the UK Haemophilia Society provide an update on the inquiry into the UK's contaminated blood scandal, which made a flurry of news at the end of 2018, in today's Share segment. Amy Board, the former executive director of the Colorado chapter of the National Haemophilia Foundation and the newest member of Believe Limited and the new host of the Ask the Expert podcast, joins us to share a bit of her story and her goals for Ask the Expert. Natalie walks us through a recent Barron's article on the right ways to invest in your health. I take us through the recent article from HemaWare on New York Rangers head coach and person with hemophilia, David Quinn. And we roll out a brand new segment called Mama Sue's Netflix Rex. All that plus news in 60 seconds and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. Natalie, I was realizing this morning as we were preparing for this that this is the first time we've actually done one of these traditionally formatted episodes in a few months.
I know. It's wild.
We had back-to-back-to-back specials, and now we're back to normal.
I love it, though. I'm excited to be back. This is fun.
I am, too. New year, new us, but old us.
Old us.
Old format, but new us in
2019.
There you go. New year, new goals. And I'm wondering, is there anything, at least as it pertains to health and 2019, that you're thinking about when it comes to goals or resolutions or...
I know a lot of people hate on resolutions. I'm a big
fan. Who hates on resolutions?
Oh my gosh, people all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
What? Who? Why?
I think people are like, oh, I'm not a resolutions person. Like, they're stupid.
Resolutions person?
But, you know, like someone who I am... I'm a resolutions person. I love that it's a new year.
Uh-huh.
And new year, new you. And
right.
This year, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, new year, old me. I'm bringing the old me into this year and a bigger, better version. Hate on, I feel like resolutions right now are being hated on a little bit. And I'm pro.
Okay. Well, let it be known, Natalie is pro resolutions.
I'm pro resolutions. And my resolutions for this year relating to health I plan for 2019 to be my healthiest year to date.
Okay. And what does that mean for you?
What does that mean for me? It means that I'm going to really, really, really put a huge focus on what I put in my body and what I put on my body. I think it's important not only to think about what you're eating, but also the products you use, because your skin is your largest organ.
And fun fact.
Yeah. And it's important. A lot of products have a lot of chemicals and a lot of hormone disrupting chemicals, which is interesting. And, you know, as we talk about family planning in the future, I feel like this year getting my body in good shape to, you know, build a family together.
To be a baby cave?
Sure. That's how ready you are for a father.
Yeah. Bring
to
it
be
on.
A baby cave.
Yep. That's right.
That's what I'm going to be.
Woke in 2019, y'all.
But yeah, what about you? Are you a resolutions guy?
I'm not going to get back to that debate, but I'm joining you in the healthiest year yet, which I think for me has a lot to do with balance and generally being a bit quieter, which is a funny thing to say in the context of a podcast that I host. But outside of the things in which I am expected to not be so quiet, I'm generally taking a quieter approach to things.
And how does that relate to social media?
Staying away from it.
Okay.
Yeah. I very much have backed off my social media game. You can find me on Twitter if you really want to engage. That's where I'm still semi-active. But for the most part, otherwise, I'm kind of staying away from it. Our channels, we've got pages for all the things we do, the Bloodstream podcast, all the stuff. But personally, I'm staying away. Too much noise, too much stuff.
I think that's a great resolution. Do you want to tell our audience what you've done with your phone at night?
Oh, yeah. My phone at night now lives in my office. So I got an actual alarm clock that has the settings that I need, and it's got some cool wake up, like a light comes on 10 minutes before some gentle piano music plays. And it's great. You can also do that to help you go to sleep. But my phone has been living the past few nights in my office, and it will continue to. One, because they say it's just generally like bad to have it near you.
Yeah. I mean, just for radiation and those right. kind of things. But also on top of that, there's been studies of screen time being the first thing you see when you wake up and the last thing before you go to bed. And it's not good for your brain. So.
I don't want that. I'm trying to reduce screen time in general.
Okay.
So I actually think that has as much to do with why I'm staying away from social media as anything, is I'm just trying to reduce screen time. And this like scrolling through people's photos and scrolling through to like... it's just not valuable enough for the screen. Like, I got to use my screen time more effectively. So yeah, those are some of my resolutions. That's why I didn't realize there was a resolutions debate raging apparently across America right now, but it's fine. I'll stay happily out of it. We've got a jam-packed show. We got a new segment, which we'll get to later. Mama Sue's Netflix Rex. We got Amy Board coming up. We've got a really interesting and insightful update on the UK's blood scandals we just mentioned. All that good stuff. But first...
Wait, can I make a comment real quickly?
No?
About, please.
Okay.
Okay. The UK blood scandal inquiry.
Yeah.
So it's not about that, but it drives me crazy how they spell hemophilia in the UK.
Why?
I don't know. When I see it written with the A and the E, it makes my brain go crazy.
Oh, boy.
I just had to get that out there. Now, I had to get it off my chest.
Yeah, we're all really glad you did. There's a few places around the world that use that spelling. And now there's also the H-E-M-O-F-I-L-I-A.
Worse. Oh,
worse.
Yes.
Even worse than the double vowel.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. They're tied for double bad.
There's so much worse. Cringing happening. Oh. There's so much cringing.
I don't know. It bothers me. Does it bother anyone else? Send us an email.
let us know. Mailbag at bloodstreampod.com. Please let her tweet at us at bloodstreaminfo on Twitter.
But I do promise that the rest of this episode has far more insightful.
We haven't recorded the rest of this episode yet. Don't make these kind of promises. We're already spending far too much time on the banter and housekeeping section. All right. We're going to kick this one off as we do often with our news, community news in 60 seconds. It is what it sounds like. Natalie and I are going to race through as many headlines from recent news and drug updates as we can possibly get through in 60 seconds. This is always the most anxious part of the recording.
I know, and I'm already agitated to having talking about the alternate spellings of hemophilia going into news in 60 seconds. So this is just going to be a disaster for me.
And with that, news, community news in 60 seconds starts now.
Past infection with hepatitis C virus is a major risk for hepatocellular carcinoma.
Oh boy.
The most common type of liver cancer. A large study analyzing more than 18,000 U.S. patients with hemophilia reported.
A single dose of BIVV001, a new investigational therapy, significantly increased levels of factor VIII for a week in the blood of people with severe hemophilia A, according to the early results of a phase 1-2A study. The treatment increased the half-life of factor VIII to 44 hours and showed no side effects or development of inhibitors.
Long-term treatment of NOV08 is safe and effective at preventing bleeding episodes in patients with hemophilia A of all ages who have already received prior treatment, a phase 3B extension trial showed.
Very nice prophylaxis with Idelvion, a fusion protein linking recombinant factor IX and albumin, significantly improved clinical outcomes and quality of life for children with hemophilia B and ease daily living for caregivers, a phase 3 trial shows.
Catalyst Biosciences recently announced updates on two of its lead compounds, factor 7A...
10 seconds.
Oh my gosh,
a lot of big words coming up.
Mars,
very close.
Factor
3 seconds.
Factor 9, Delk A, for treatment of hemophilia A and B. Am I out?
I like, yeah, you're so out. Yeah, you're so out. I like the usage of. It's just like an acceptance of, I'm not even trying, but if I just make sounds, I can go on to the next word. Well, as understandable as all of that was, if you would like more information on any of those or the news we didn't get to, you can click the links in our program notes. And that is, as always, the very valuable
news in 60 seconds.
Community news in 60 seconds. It's a segment, but it's also like a section. What was our previous debate over?
Segments and sections. What? Community news, news.
Tomato, tomato, you know, it is what it is. This month's like segment from Natalie, the right way to invest in your health, a recent article on Barron's on the way to spend money to make the most of your health. Natalie, what is this all about?
So it's an interesting article looking at health as a return on investment and from a financial POV. The average American spends $155 a month on discretionary health and fitness costs. And those are things like nutritional supplements, workout clothes, healthy meal plans, personal trainers. And then, like, as a nation, we passed the 30 billion mark several years ago.
Congratulations to us.
For complementary health approaches. So that's not even like healthcare costs. That's things such like,
in addition,
yeah,
to
supplements, acupuncture, chiropractors.
Yeesh.
Yeah. And there's even a new category that's called wellness real estate. And it's featuring building materials that are designed to lower stress, improve sleep, productivity. You know, floors that are...
You can really throw wellness in front of anything, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, and in the global sense, we've swollen to $4.2 trillion, and that includes $600 billion in wellness tourism.
What is wellness tourism?
I mean, I'm sure that means like yoga retreats, meditation retreats, all kinds of travel retreats that are focused on health and good eating, weight loss retreats.
So is all of this working?
So what this article says is that a lot of it, there's not a great ROI. So, but what we could focus on...
Can I pause you?
Yeah.
When you say there's not a great ROI, I take it they're not... Like, what? How are they defining the ROI?
That, like, we're spending a lot of money on these things, but they're not actually...
We're not getting weller?
We're not getting weller.
Okay.
And that there are actually things you can do that are free or low cost that would have a greater impact. Like one thing they highlight is sleep. And they say 40% of Americans get less than the recommended amount, which is at least 7 hours.
I'm in that category.
Yes, you are. And that there's a bunch of huge health problems that come from that. High anxiety, high blood pressure, drowsy driving that results in fatal car crashes, and that even though the billions of dollars being put into wellness, sleep is not improving. Hmm. In fact, people are turning to caffeine in greater numbers. Millennials are drinking the world's coffee supply dry, as this article states.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
We're gulping the coffee. So people could do things that are cheap, free, or low cost, such as what you're doing, what you've said earlier, turning off screens earlier, going to bed earlier, taking magnesium, disconnecting from work earlier in the day so that your brain's shutting down, and that like increased a couple hours of sleep would have a bigger health return. Instead, they're saying we're spending thousands of dollars on things like DNA tests, so we know like diagnostically what to look for, but those aren't even necessarily accurate. And people are spending like thousands of dollars on that. Another thing that it said that we could do is just increasing our exercise to 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. And it saves people an average of $2,500 a year if you're exercising.
In healthcare costs. Wow.
So instead of, you know, spending money on those meal kits, those meal plans that come in, juice cleanses.
There's a fair number of insurance plans or like jobs who they'll give you some kind of voucher or like financial compensation if you show that you've worked out a certain amount.
Yeah,
or,
like,
right?
There. I know my mom's company reimburses on insurance for steps if she's wearing a Fitbit and she can track her steps.
Right, right.
So basically.
Some incentives out there.
Yeah. And also an interesting stat that they had in here was that people who exercise make 9% more in annual salary than their counterparts who do not exercise. And that could be, you know, there's maybe if you're more disciplined to exercise, you might be more disciplined in work. Like there might be some personality traits.
Right.
But also too that it might just increase your productivity.
Yeah.
So exercise not only can save you money, but can make you more money.
I mean, I definitely feel more productive on days where I have exercised before I've gone to do my productive thing.
For sure. And there's greater mental clarity, I think.
Yeah.
You're less
for sure.
Less sluggish. So
wow.
Yeah.
Man, we're spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
A lot of money.
A lot of money. And that it could just be better spent. I mean, not that these things are bad, but the article's interesting in its entirety and it's just kind of eye opening to think of health as an investment. And the return on that investment. So.
Yeah, and I mean, my big takeaway though is kind of, if anything, just set yourself up for better sleep. You know, before you even spend another dollar on something, set yourself up for a little bit better sleep. And it seems like it seems as though the article is suggesting that would be a more effective next step than trying to, I don't know, find another thing to buy that's going to add to your wellness.
Yeah, you're super stressed, but you're only getting 5 hours of sleep, and then you're trying to jam in a yoga class, and you're trying to jam in 30 hours of meditation.
This is a de-stress tea. It's just like go to bed.
Yeah, so it's saying that some of the free and cheap options could actually have a greater return.
I've often thought it is funny how much of like Eastern philosophy that we have brought into and commercialized in the Western world. And like, you know, I don't think the monks or those in the like meditation, long walks, sleeping, yoga, like you can do all that stuff for free.
Yeah.
You don't need to spend money. But I don't know. There is this like, we love spending money on stuff. Culturally, we just love spending money on stuff. I'm as guilty as anybody in my own ways, but yeah, it is a little sick and twisted. All right, well, hey, thanks. We'll try to get a little bit better sleep. At least the phone's in the office now. So this is the part of the podcast where we remind you that the Bloodstream Podcast is brought to you by Shire, and Natalie would like to do that part.
Well, so I was thinking about ads and advertisements, and I think what we need on the Bloodstream Podcast is a Shire jingle. Because I think jingles are really catchy, and then people remember. So I have a couple of options.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
That I'd like to just test out.
Let's do it.
Okay. Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Shire wiener. That's what I truly like to be.
Dun, 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 dun.
'Cause if I were an Oscar Shire wiener, everyone would be in love with me.
Okay.
What do you think? What do you think?
That's a great option. It reminds me of something. I can't put my finger on it, but I can see how it might work. It feels like it's maybe a little long. Do you have any like maybe tighter jingle options or?
I'll work on it.
You'll work on it. Oh, yeah. That's our option for
now. That's our option for now.
I think we're off to a good start.
I took a long time to write that.
I can tell.
Okay.
Let us come back to the table.
Okay.
Let's go through another couple red pen revisions and maybe try out another one maybe toward the end of the podcast. Maybe we can see what else we've got in the cooker.
Okay. I'll start writing.
Okay. Fantastic.
All right.
Thanks, Natalie. Bloodstream listeners might remember Clive Smith from his Share segment, I think back in September, actually, coincidentally, the last time Natalie and I were doing one of these traditionally formatted episodes. We reached out to Clive and asked him, given that the inquiry into the UK's infected blood scandal was picking up a lot of steam toward the end of the year. There was a number of announcements, speeches that were given, and there was a lot of coverage on it. So we asked Clive if he and the UK society could put together, for the benefit of a greater and mostly American audience, an update on what exactly is going on in the UK's infected blood inquiry. So here again, we have Clive Smith presenting an update on the UK infected blood inquiry.
UK Infected Blood Inquiry Update. On the 11th of July 2017, Prime Minister Theresa May announced the public inquiry into the contaminated blood scandal in the United Kingdom. Over 30 years since the disaster, an inquiry which had been called on for over a decade is finally taking place. This fact inevitably begs the question, why now? Especially after so many other countries around the world have seemingly dealt with the scandal already. There's no simple answer, but we at the Haemophilia Society see three primary factors. Firstly, the political situation. All the leaders of the major opposition UK political parties put their names to a letter asking for a public inquiry. Secondly, Andy Burnham, now Mayor of Greater Manchester, stepped down as an MP in April 2017. During his last speech in Parliament, he stated that he had evidence of criminal conduct which he would pass to police for investigation if an inquiry was not set up. Lastly, a group legal action had been taken out against government in relation to a 1991 court settlement. That settlement stated that those infected with HIV would receive ex gratia payments from government and, in return, had to sign a waiver stating that they would take no further legal action against government. The waiver included action for hepatitis infection, despite many of the affected not knowing their status at the time. These combined factors, along with all the campaigning that's been going on for years, finally tipped the balance. Right off the bat, there are issues. For example, the inquiry was to be run by the Department of Health, a body central to the inquiry itself. A meeting was held amongst campaign groups, including the Haemophilia Society, chaired by the Bishop of Liverpool, who wrote a letter on group's behalf to the Prime Minister, stating that the inquiry should be moved to another sponsoring government department. Eventually, government listened and the inquiry was moved to the Cabinet Office. Another issue the Haemophilia Society raised is that many are still not public about their diagnosis and so would need a mechanism by which their evidence could be taken without revealing their identity. The inquiry team were very receptive to this, and a process has been put in place to accommodate the infected and affected who will fall into this category. Additionally, the Society is extremely concerned about the psychological impact the inquiry will have on its members and others. Many will be traumatised by the giving of evidence and re-traumatised generally by the inquiry at large. We know that since the announcement of the inquiry and launch, another 80 people have died. Currently, a telephone helpline is in place which only runs for 6 hours a week. We are continuing to campaign the government and inquiry to address this concern. A significant aspect of the inquiry for us here at the Society is that some of our actions during the early 80s will also be investigated. Upon medical advice, the Society advised members to keep taking the Factor VIII products which were contaminated. The Society itself lost 3 out of 6 of its own trustees during that time as a result of following that advice. The Society has apologised for the harm caused in consequence of that advice and has committed to submitting itself to scrutiny during this phase of the investigation. Over the last 6 months, members of campaign groups, including the Society, have made applications for core participant status. A core participant can be represented by a legal team during the inquiry, allowing them the ability to put forward questions to be asked at the inquiry and potentially ask questions themselves. It also means they will have access to much of the evidence disclosed to the inquiry. Nearly 1,300 core participants have been appointed thus far. In September 2018, the inquiry formally began with 3 days of public hearings. The first day featured a moving commemoration service with music and testimonials from those who had lost loved ones over the years. The ensuing 2 days were for core participants to make opening statements, including government bodies who are to be investigated, such as the Department of Health. The inquiry will recommence its work at the end of April 2019 with personal testimony from the infected and affected. The inquiry received significant public attention at its launch, with print and broadcast media present for all 3 days conducting interviews with the infected and affected. The Society itself gave a dozen interviews on the first day alone, including being live on BBC News. We continue to receive much media attention and are working to keep the inquiry at the top of the political agenda during the current Brexit process. The inquiry has seemingly made a strong start, and many hold out hope that justice will finally be delivered. It's expected to last 3 years or more, and there will be many more challenges along the way. The Society remains committed to serving its members and supporting them through this demanding time in our history.
Thank you, Clive, for that update. And as he mentioned at the end of that update there, that this will be going on for some time. So you can expect that we will have another update from the UK Haemophilia Society on the inquiry later this year as there's a bit more news to report. So thank you again, Clive. And if you'd like to keep up with what's going on within the UK, you can find the UK Haemophilia Society, spelt as, in a way that Natalie just cannot stand, all over social media, on Twitter, on Facebook. You can find the UK Haemophilia Society. You don't have to do it. I'll keep you, Natalie, informed. You don't have to read that spelling. I know that's really gives you agita.
I can't read that spelling.
I know.
I can't say haemophilia if it's spelled that way.
Haemophilia.
Yeah. I'm always a little bit like, hey. Haemophilia.
Okay. To each their own. Thank you, Clive. All right, this month's comment segment comes from NHF's magazine HemAware, an article titled New York Rangers Head Coach David Quinn on Hockey and Haemophilia, written by Caitlin Kelly. So David Quinn is the 52-year-old first-year head coach of the National Hockey League's New York Rangers, my hometown team. Shout out to the 1994 Mark Messier-led championship team. He is a former player himself and has mild haemophilia B. Quinn grew up as one of three siblings in Rhode Island and was born in 1966 to his narcotics detective father and school bus driver mother. Played sports a lot all throughout his youth and into high school, became excelled at hockey. And in fact, he went to a prestigious boarding school on a hockey scholarship, and in 1984 was selected 13th overall in the first round of the NHL entry draft, which is pretty incredible. He opted instead to forego that option and accepted a scholarship to Boston University to play hockey at that prestigious school. Now, Quinn at this point did not realize that he had haemophilia, but after his first 2 years playing for BU were marred by injuries and a lot of time away, his coach had actually eventually suggested that he be tested and screened for haemophilia, which, just shout out to that coach right there, because a guy even getting to the point where he's playing his sophomore year at Boston University on the hockey team, for the coach to even think that maybe some of these injuries we were seeing were related to haemophilia is pretty impressive. And sure, he was right. As Quinn said, I knew zero about haemophilia. I thought I could take a pill and I'd be cured. But once they told me what it was scary. I'd already played 2 years of college hockey. The family later found out that his mother was in fact a carrier and her father in fact had haemophilia. In spite of the diagnosis, he carried on and was trying to continue playing at BU. And he was even invited to the U.S. Olympic hockey trials in 1987. But just 3 weeks before they began, he sprained his ankle, and as had become a bit of a pattern with Quinn, based on what this article says, that sprain quickly turned into a massive leg bleed, which led to surgery and an extended hospital stay. And it was that experience that finally led Quinn to acknowledge that he was going to have to hang up his skates. So that was the end of his playing career. And in talking about that, the article quotes Quinn as saying, "The realization led to some dark days. I was definitely a pissed and rattled and depressed human being. I tried to put up a good front, but it wasn't easy. The only thing that helps you through it is time and finding another passion." And for David Quinn, that passion became coaching. One of his old coaches, Ben Smith, kind of helped him find a path where he was able to begin discovering what that new passion was and pursue it professionally. So after stints with a number of different teams, University of Nebraska, an assistant developmental coach for USA Hockey, and some other opportunities, he returned to BU, where he coached for 5 years, won two conference titles and led the Terriers, my alma mater, by the way, shout out to the Terriers, not the most intimidating mascot, but hey, take what you can get, to the NCAA National Championship game in 2015. And then just this year, accepted and started, or I should say this season, his first year as coach of the New York Rangers. Final quote from Quinn: the hemophilia world can be a world of no and extra cautiousness. Every person with hemophilia has their own limitations, but with the proper medical guidance, we can figure out what we can do. So a few things jumped out to me from this article. One, well, it's just cool that there's an NHL coach who has hemophilia. Like, that's just...
And former hockey player.
A former hockey player himself, who probably would not have been a hockey player had he had his diagnosis. And I don't think I mentioned his diagnosis, as you might imagine, of course, is mild hemophilia. He has mild hemophilia B. Very unlikely that he would have moderate or severe and have gotten that far along in his playing career before it was noticed. But, you know, it's funny how a late-stage diagnosis for Quinn at 20, and even of, say, a mild bleeding disorder, and he says, you know, it doesn't really affect his day-to-day life. His factor levels are such that unless he's getting a surgery or a dental procedure, he doesn't really have to think of it now that he's not playing hockey. But how it really rattled his core, and how it can really rattle your sense of self. If you're 20, 25, 30, 35, and again, even if it is a mild diagnosis, you've had all these years of identifying yourself in the world and understanding who you are, and then all of a sudden you learn you actually have this thing. You've had it all your life. It's that's got to be a bit jarring. I thought it was relevant or noteworthy that he pointed out the importance of navigating that shift into a new passion, and how often a bleeding disorder forces someone who's either a young athlete or pursuing anything, maybe, into having to make another choice for one reason or another, and the importance of letting time and some new inspiration, some new passion lead you to that new thing. And again, shout out to that coach, Ben Smith, for essentially being part of his support network that enabled him to do so successfully and find that avenue in coaching. And that's the last thing that jumped out to me, is that for Quinn, he was able to adapt from within. So he was able to stay within the world of hockey, and this world that he had obviously really taken an affinity to as a player for the first 20 years of his life, and start finding another way that he could serve it as a coach. And I think for other people, myself included, adapting from within isn't necessarily the right option or the healthiest option. It's not satisfying whatever that other thing you'd rather be doing was. I was very interested in pursuing coaching basketball until I found something that actually kind of struck me on a deeper level and didn't feel like a replacement for the thing I'd rather be doing. So everybody's different. For Coach Quinn, he was able to find a way to adapt from within the world of hockey. For somebody like me, I had to step outside and away from athletics when it just became something that was clearly not going to be a part of my future, and turn towards something entirely different where my passions were able to flourish. But everybody is different. Congratulations to Coach Quinn. I know I meant to look up what the Rangers' record is right now. I don't know, to be honest, but they're probably doing good.
Yeah, we'll say they're doing good.
They're doing really good. Hey, yeah. They had that game. See that game?
Oh my gosh, I watch so much hockey.
What's your favorite thing about hockey?
The ice.
Nice.
I mean, I know a lot about ice.
It's okay. Well, unfortunately, Natalie, we don't have time to get into that right now. We'll have to end
the
comments.
Well, if you like ice, you'll like hockey.
Mailbag at bloodstream.com. All right. And that's it for this month's comment segment. We'll be right back with Amy Board in this month's interview segment. All right. So I am joined now by a friend, and I'm very proud to say now a colleague as well, the former executive director of the Colorado chapter of the National Hemophilia Foundation, the most recent addition to the Believe Limited team, and the new host of the Ask the Expert podcast, Amy Board. Hello, Amy.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello.
Well, how are you? How's 2019 in this new position going so far? What are we, 12 days in?
12 days in. I made it. I haven't destroyed anything. I haven't made anyone mad yet. It's terrific. It's terrific. It's amazing.
It's incredible how much you can accomplish in under 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Or at the very least, how much damage you can avoid doing in under 2 weeks. But people active in the community will likely know at least your name, if not know you personally, from your role for 7 years with the Colorado chapter of NHF. So I want to talk to you about taking over the Ask the Expert podcast, what you're hoping to do there, and what you're envisioning your role with Believe to be. But let's start with a little bit of your backstory. How did you wind up the executive director of the National Hemophilia Foundation's Colorado chapter? How did that come to be?
Oh, man, that is a tale. That is a tale. it's very random. I am not affected personally by hemophilia or another bleeding disorder. My undergrad degree is in musical theater, and I was a professional actress for just a little under a decade. And when I was performing, I would travel around regionally to do different shows in different states. And when I was home, you know, I would have, you know, like a month here or 6 weeks there to just find a job and do something, you know, in between shows. And my very dear family friend who went to graduate school with my father, actually, Judy Primo, started and ran the 340B pharmacy at our hemophilia treatment center in Denver, and she gave me a job. My job actually was to file away, the hemophilia community knows this really well, but Dr. Mango Johnson's very, visionary study, which basically was the, you know, she's the godmother of prophylactic treatment. It was the joint outcome study. My job was actually to scan all of those records into the computer because the majority of the records were on paper at the time. So I got introduced to hemophilia there.
Sounds like a
there.
Laborious task to start
I know.
With.
Yeah, it was brutal. But I remember sitting on the floor with like tons of patient records around me, you know, just taking things out of each file that I needed. And I was so fascinated that there were all these people that were related to one another. And I saw a lot of obituaries from the HIV crisis, and I was just fascinated. Mm. You know, it was instantly relational. You know, all of these family members and all of these people that, Judy, my friend, knew so well, and she knew their family. She had been in their home. She had, she knew the backstory to these people. And so it was instantly relational. Right. And I remember being instantly drawn to it. And when I moved back to Denver permanently to really start my career in Denver as a theater actress, I started working at the treatment center more and more because it was the best gig of all time. You know, I would be able to not work during rehearsals. We would have like 4 week rehearsals where it was, 10 to 10, and I wouldn't be able to have another job. And then I would work like 3 days a week when we were doing shows, and I would work full time when I was in between shows. So it was just this perfect job. And I, worked my way up. I was a pharmacy tech for a while. That's where I met Chris Bombardier. And then, a couple years into it, leadership came to me and asked if I wanted to be involved in hemophilia camp. And I was, I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea what they really meant. And they shipped me down to Texas. I went to Camp Allopoma for 1 year, and it changed my life. I totally drank the Kool-Aid. And so I was kind of hooked. I remember I came back and was telling a girlfriend how just about my experience at camp and what it was like. And she looked at me and she said, "You've never been this animated or passionate about theater ever." She goes, "I don't think I've ever heard you like this ever." And it was a while. You know, I decided to stop acting. It just didn't feel like it just, I don't know, sustained my soul. It was a weird, interesting time. I don't think I left it well, but I had these.
What do you mean you don't think you left it well?
Well, I was angry. I was just kind of angry and burnt out and bitter, I think. And I didn't want to go into a theater again for a long time. And I actually, it was very weird. I went out on top. I didn't have a negative experience. I actually went out on top, which is like the opposite thing of what you would think it would be. And
yeah, that's good.
Yeah. But it was just weird. It was weird for a while. And spent 3 years having no idea what I was going to do. I worked in the treatment center a little bit, running camp, doing programs, having no idea what to do. And then my predecessor in the ED job was a nonprofit consultant. So that's what she did in real life. And she got her graduate degree in nonprofit management. And when I started working with her, it was just, again, it was kind of an enlightening, an enlightening thing of, oh my gosh, nonprofit work, how rewarding, and you can make a living doing this, and you're raising money for a thing that you believe in. I was so enamored by it. And I was like, I'm getting this degree.
Yeah.
And so I went back and got my degree and did not think that I would have anything to do with hemophilia because she had the job. I just thought I would, you know, bide my time for a while. And then she resigned like 3 weeks or 3 months rather into my graduate degree. And so I came into the role and I've been there for seven years.
Oh, that's interesting. So you weren't necessarily thinking that you would be sticking within hemophilia once you were on the degree pursuit. It felt like, okay, hemophilia kind of led me to seeing this, but now that I'm going down this path, someone's got the job over here in hemophilia, but now I know about this avenue for myself, and then the job in hemophilia just so happened to open up.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting timing.
I know.
You know, it struck me when you said earlier about the relational component of the community and looking at all the stories and all these people are related to each other. And it just kind of made me think, as someone with a background in creative and in storytelling, I wonder if because hemophilia is a small town and it affects families and it's a rare disease population, a small population, I wonder if in some ways it appealed to you and to the creative storyteller in you in a way that maybe a larger disease state wouldn't, because it might just feel bigger. It might not feel as personal, and maybe the needs therefore wouldn't feel as high. I don't know. Have you ever given that any thought?
Not as eloquently as you have placed it, Patrick. You're incredible. But I do think that is what drew me to it. And, you know, I had a very unique lens to begin this career in hemophilia. I worked in the treatment center for so long. And so I was groomed by clinicians. And I'm not clinical. I mean, I am a creative theater nerd at my core. And I felt so weird there for a while. And it took me a long time to learn how to relate to them because they relate so differently. And watching them interact with patients, and the majority of these women and physicians, they have known these families and these young men since they were born. And I was just charmed by it. I just loved it. It was just this wonderful thing and you're right, I haven't found it anywhere else. And I have searched in vain, you know, to try to find someone else, another disease state that we can learn from or partner with that's like the hemophilia community. And I mean, it just isn't out there.
Is there something that through your 7 years as the ED in Colorado, is there anything in particular that when you look back on that time, you are particularly proud for either having started or for having advanced significantly or having added to the organization's mission? Is there a stamp or a footprint that you've left that you're like, you know, I'm really proud of that?
Absolutely. I think it actually took me leaving to, I think, remember it and actually, you know, kind of say within my heart, like, yeah, you did do that. Because it doesn't seem like it's like an objective on a piece of paper that can be very fancy, even though I think it was the foundation of everything that we do. When I took over as ED, the Colorado chapter was really decimated. And, you know, the first event that I went to as the ED, it was kind of like the send-off event. You know, my predecessor was leaving and I was taking over, was our education weekend, our family education weekend that most chapters hold. And we were in a very cold clinical room at the treatment center. It was at the medical campus. And I think there was over like 35, 40 industry representatives there. And there was a handful of HTC clinicians. And I think there was like 8 patients. And it was real bleak. And it, you know, the energy was really... you know, it wasn't fun. And, you know, I was the camp person. I when I came into that role, I knew the majority of these families personally. And I had you know, taken their kids for a week. And it's this lovely thing. And I was high energy and just really decided to make every event as fun as possible. And I think the reason that I don't hold it as like I did anything, because it just doesn't seem very intellectual. I think it was all personality of just like, I just come to this event so we can all be together and it's going to be fun to like draw these people in. And, you know, I think the next year and the next 2 years, that event had over 150 community members. I mean, it exploded real quick.
Wow.
And I think that
and
was
just from the outreach that you were doing and trying and that community building direct outreach kind of work. Is
yeah.
that what you credit that boom to?
And messaging. I think I was really, you know, I was typical Amy relational on Facebook, you know, through our Facebook page and through our e-newsletters. And we would just document everything is like, look at how much fun we're having. And because of that energy that it's, you know, it's not, we are not going to have this be a, you know, it doesn't have to be a thing. It doesn't have to be a drama. And I think for Colorado, that's what it was. It was drama. And it was this volunteer organization that everyone had their hand in. And it just became this pain point. It was drama and it was painful. And it's like, we're not going to do that. You have a staff member that is not in the community that's going to set everything up. And your job is just to come and to relate to one another and to learn and to connect and to find support and to, you know, use it as you need to in the moment that you need to. And there was no pressure, you know, there was, you know, you don't have to make this anything that you aren't comfortable with, and just to humanize it. You know, just to have some warmth to people coming in. And, you know, I think it was an intense 7 years. Obviously, running an organization is very intense. And there were some things I did well and there were some things that I really didn't. And leaving it, you know, I was exhausted. And just, you know, these families, these people just saying, we didn't have anything before you came and we're so grateful. It was by 100%, that is the thing that I'm most proud of.
You know, and I feel like with any transition, there's not just one thing that necessarily leads someone to making that transition. So I'm sure there's numerous reasons that you were at a point in your professional growth, maybe in your personal life, that you were just ready for the next phase of what was next, what's coming next. But how did you know that this time period, late 2018 into 2019, was the right time for you to move on to the next phase of your life?
Well, I think the organization was sustainable for me to do it. You know, we were at a place where we could hire, you know, we were going to have three full-time people, an ED, a full-time fundraiser development person, and a full-time program manager. And it just felt like it was time. I think I had, I think the organization, and I had known this for a while, actually, for several months, I had really felt that the organization will not go forward with me in the role. I just didn't feel like it was. My energy had kind of started to peter out, and I was just looking for other avenues. And it was just that time, you know, It needed new eyes on it, I think. And so it felt like time. It really did. It really did. And what a tremendous community that Colorado community is. I mean, they are so engaged and involved. And I had wanted so deeply to build something that wasn't leaning completely on my shoulders, you know, that it wasn't Amy Board show. And then when she left, it would be gone. I really right. wanted to instill in them that this is your organization as a community, you know, as you guys flow, you know, it truly is yours. It is not mine. It's not any staff member that's coming in. It is our honor to serve it and to work for it, but it is yours. It is your responsibility to be on committees. It is your responsibility to work with camp. It is your responsibility to donate to the organization for sustainability. It's your duty to do these things as you flow through the community. You'll be involved sometimes and then you won't. You know, when your kids are, you know, 14 and you're going to soccer 6 days a week, like you're not going to be involved. And that's okay. And someone else will come up you know, to take that place.
Yeah, it's the testament to having a strong system over a strong superstar. It's great to have superstars in positions of leadership and positions to thrive and succeed within a system. But if you don't have a system to support the whole thing, then like you said, it becomes Amy's show. And that can be very successful, at least so long as Amy can behave superhumanly. You know, I used to think about that at camp. Sure, for a week, I can be up at 7 a.m. and go full steam ahead, all energy, all day, every day until 11 p.m. I can do that for a week. But if I had to do that week over week, month over month, year over year, I would probably be dead before the end of year one. So it's a testament that to you that you were able to recognize that in order for this organization to be successful in the long run, whatever short-term success we may be having because of my sheer force of will and my ability to connect online and pull people into the community, if the system is not set up in such a way that gives community agency over their organization and gives staff agency over their positions and board agency over their responsibility, then the success will always be short-lived. So that's a credit to you for recognizing that and setting the organization up to succeed when it was indeed time for you to move on to being over here with Believe. And I have to ask you, you've just finished your first week onboarding, so to speak, and you and I have had numerous conversations over the past couple few months in preparation for this transition. But I would love to hear now, a week into your job, I guess, technically with Believe, what do you see it as now? How do you see it developing? And what are you most looking forward to? And we'll talk about the podcast specifically in a moment, but I want to hear from a higher level what you're looking forward to in this new capacity.
Oh my goodness. It was a really overwhelming, stimulating week. It was really good. I haven't been, you know, this is another thing that's kind of interesting. I've never had a job change before. You know, I when I came into the executive director position, I had been borderline doing that on the behind the scenes with program stuff. I knew exactly what I would do. I was all alone in an office and I just did it. And this is the first time that I've gone into something, you know, I was an actor for all those years. And, you know, this is the first time I've ever done that. And it was really interesting. You know, I've onboarded a lot of staff members. So there were some things in my brain of like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. You'll be annoying. But it was fantastic. I think, you know, one of the things that I loved about it that is so, it's a testament to Believe and, you know, the creative brains that I'm working with is that, you know, the three of us in leadership positions, you and me and Ryan, we really came to the, you know, agreement that we were going to let this role really develop into what it was going to be. We weren't going to, you know, set it in some certain parameter. And it just feels so like things are going to click into place. I think the thing that I have felt most like I've been able to contribute to instantly is my favorite thing about being the ED, my favorite thing was being able to use my voice, my unique voice, my theater nerd voice to advocate for these people that I believe in and to tell their story in a way that people haven't heard before or to make them understand and empathize. That's why I loved about public policy. It's what I loved about advocacy in Washington days. And I have felt the ability to do that instantly in this job. For creative fun things, you know, we were in a meeting where, you know, we talked to some, you know, potential funders about, you know, the importance of camp for one thing. And it was just this lovely thing to have these people that don't understand, that have never been there, for me to tell the story of how uniquely perfect those weeks are for these children and how important it is. And I love that. It's my favorite thing. So that's been the first thing. And then just the opportunity and the possibility to blend my theater nerd side with this community that I love. I mean, that's going to be the best, you know, to have some education component of it and to, you know, to be able to work with those kids and teenagers again. You know, I haven't been able to do that in a long time, and I'm very excited about that.
And I am really, really excited to have someone with as much experience as you have on the executive director, patient organization side of things joining our team, because as you know from when we have been partners on Believe coming to do programs for the Colorado chapter, we're often interacting with executive directors and their staff and leadership about what it will be to either come as facilitators or to work with that chapter on a unique pilot program of some kind. So to have your expertise from that realm now part of our team, I think is going to set us up even better for those opportunities and help us find more of them, because you can help us identify gaps that we could fill that we just might not even know to look for. And additionally, it's great for me to have another community-facing individual as a part of this team. With your experience, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, you're not someone who is personally affected by a bleeding disorder, but your years of experience now give you the background, the knowledge base, the wherewithal to be a community-facing representative from our team and someone who has a finger on the pulse of what's going on and can contextualize the news of the minute against the greater community over time. And those are responsibilities that have largely been with me. And I'm very happy now to be sharing that with someone else and with someone who, again, has that different background to draw from. So pulling this now into specifically the podcast realm, the Ask the Expert podcast, we've known Chris Bombardier as the host of it through 2018. I understand that he will be your very first guest in a little bit of a passing of the baton to the new host. But can you tell us, what are you hoping as host of the Ask the Expert podcast now to accomplish with that, and what might we see from Ask the Expert in 2019?
I'll be honest with you, I'm just hoping to not blow it. You know what I mean? I just don't want to blow it.
Setting that bar high, board. Setting that bar high.
There's all these technical things, these buttons I have to push to record. It's really stressful. No, JK.
There are a lot of buttons.
No, this was always in the conversation, but it wasn't until this week that it was like, oh, this is mine. I get to take this and go. And it was just kind of a lovely thing of like, oh my gosh, this is the first way that I can utilize my, you know, nerdy place in this community to storytell. And I'm psyched about it. I love that it's very specific. I love that, there is this insatiable need for education in this community. You know, this community is hungry for it. And in all honesty, I don't think that's different than the majority of chronic disease states. You know, my mother has several, and she is hungry for information all the time. I just read a memoir about a woman who has early onset dementia, and her story of trying to find information that is not overly clinical, that will speak to an actual patient. It just really moved me that this is so important, and to take it seriously. And that excites me. I think the thing that I'm most excited about is, you know, talking to people that have some type of expertise can be intimidating. I'm intimidated by it, to be honest with you. And I think I'm going to push into it a little bit. And I hope to find a style, a conversational style that will humanize these folks. I'm not exactly sure. I've played around with a lot of different things, like how can we bring humor into this? How can we, you know, humanize these people? You know, can I ask them about their dogs and like what they're going to have for dinner? You know, those types of things to just like try to break the ice a little bit, but to also...
The answer is yes, by the way.
Oh, good. Thanks, boss. But to also utilize my non-clinicalness in hopefully a charming way to be like, you know what? I don't know what that means. You're going to have to please start over and tell it to me like I'm in sixth grade, you know, because I think that, you know, my experience with our clinicians in my own HTC here in Colorado, that has been the most enjoyable thing for me, is to humanize some of those physicians for our families and to remind them that they're just people. And so you really can say, wow, I didn't understand any of that. Tell it to me like I'm in first grade. So I'm hoping that's what it becomes. I'm hoping that I know there's going to be dense information, but I hope it becomes enjoyable. I hope it becomes something that people subscribe to and listen to because they know they'll get good things. I want to keep the the patient and the caregiver in the forefront always in terms of our messaging with it to, if they're in crisis, you know, that they can utilize the resource, that it won't be just lost somewhere. And I'm not exactly sure how to do that, but I think that is a need. You know, hemophilia is manageable a lot of the time. You know, it's a lot of the time. And then you get into this one place and you have no idea what to do. And it's, you know, it's terrifying. So I want to be aware of that and to have that be a resource.
So then as a final question here, knowing that you did just fit, just before we're recording, you wrapped your first interview with former host Chris Bombardier. You know, we've had him on Bloodstream, and he's obviously been the voice of Ask the Expert for a while. Can you give us maybe a little sneak peek? Is there one thing that came up in that interview that maybe listeners haven't heard before, or a little sneak peek of news that he may have broken with you that you don't mind sharing with us here on Bloodstream?
Actually, the thing that I loved the most about it was he hasn't talked about any of this stuff publicly before. We talk about it a little bit. Like, I didn't ask you one thing about Everest, and we kind of laughed about it. You know, he, you know, being his friend for over 10 years and his close, dear friend for the last couple, you know, he has this this passion and this mission and this vision for what he wants to do specifically with Save One Life now that he's working there full time. And, you know, his thoughts and his knowledge and expertise specifically on global health and some of the barriers that we are all facing in terms of treatment disparity and how to relate to people culturally are so substantial and rich and wonderful. And we talk about that. I mean, we really talk about his involvement with Save One Life, what he thinks the role is going to be like, where he sees the organization going, and what it can be for us getting involved. What are some steps that we can actually do as community members that might feel completely inadequate with it? So it's kind of a new thing. We don't talk about mountain climbing at all.
Fantastic. I think we've done that pretty well across the Bloodstream network. So if you're not already subscribed to Ask the Expert on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever it is that you can find podcasts, subscribe now. You can also go to bloodstreamexpert.com and follow the links there to subscribe. Amy's first episode will be coming up at the end of this month. And again, Amy, I am thrilled to have you as a part of this team, as the host and the voice of Ask the Expert. And I'm very excited to see what it is that we're going to be able to accomplish with you on board.
Oh, snap.
Thank you very much for indulging my pun. And thank you, Amy, for being our guest today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Patrick.
Parting shots and our latest segment, Mama Sue's Netflix Rex, coming up in just a moment. But we are actually first going to go back here to Natalie. I hear that we have an update on the Shire jingle that you've been working on. What do you have for us, Natalie?
I've been writing furiously over here, and I've come up with some real original stuff.
Well, we can't wait to hear it.
Okay, so I did find out that the jingle that I had sang before was very similar to an old jingle for a hot dog company.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So too similar.
Interesting. Just tapped into the zeitgeist, I guess.
I know. Yeah. So copyright issues.
Right. Yeah, we don't want to go down that path.
I wrote a few other ones.
Oh, wonderful. What do you got?
Okay. Like a good neighbor, Shire is there.
Okay. So what I like about it is that it's shorter. We talked earlier about like...
That's why I made that one, yeah.
It does kind of remind me, though, of another jingle.
But like, Shire is such a good, supportive company. Mm-hmm. They support the Bloodstream podcast.
Right.
They are awesome.
Yeah, good point. Doesn't change the fact that I'm pretty sure that jingle might already...
No, but what I mean is like, they're supportive like a good neighbor.
No, that part's like, coming through really clearly. Okay. I think the part you're not clicking into is that jingle exists already.
Okay. Well, I do have a few more.
I think we have time for one more, but maybe if you could choose one that's like an original, brand new, just kind of came up with it on your own.
Give me a break. Give me a break. Break me off a piece of that Shire Farm.
Shire Farm?
Pharma. I mean, it's...
Oh, I see.
Yeah, like...
Like Splinter the company off so that they can like sell some of it to you or something?
No, just like...
That was a bad back salta joke.
I don't know. What do you think of that one?
You know, I think, again, they're great. They're all great. And
they're catchy, right?
But they are really catchy. You wrote some real catchy jingles there, Natalie. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Hey, thank you.
And thanks, Shire.
Thank you, Shire. Okay, I'm very excited for this. I've actually not really been able to sit still the last couple of hours in anticipation of our first ever Mama Sue's Netflix Rex, where we're bringing back one of Bloodstream Podcast's favorite guests. You're actually one of everybody's favorite guests, my mother, Susan Lynch. Hi, Mom.
Hi there, honey. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Yeah? Feeling a little nervous?
No, not at all.
Oh, look at you. Cool as a cucumber. Okay. Well, so let's give a little backstory here, because for a very long time, for a very long time, none of us had smart TVs. But for a while, I was telling you know, we should get you a smart TV, Mom. You get the apps, this, that. And you were like, no, I like what I have. And then since you've gotten the smart TV, do you even watch regular television anymore?
And of course, you gave me the smart TV a year ago this past Christmas. And I remember even the TV I had before that you had gotten me, and you wanted me to get it then. And I was very stubborn. I don't need a smart TV. I'm not going to watch Netflix, blah, blah, blah. To be honest, if I watch 5% of regular TV, it's a lot. Everything I watch is either Netflix or Prime, Amazon.
And I often now get texts from you about things you're watching that you're excited about. You watch a lot of documentaries, which, of course, I'm a fan of and make.
You probably think I'm silly because I'll be watching it and I start like giving you a movie critique and you're not even asking for it. And I just like give you these random critiques. But I've really watched some fantastic shows on these TV shows, on these channels.
Okay, and so that's why we're here. So this segment, each time, we're going to feature three things that you're either watching now or have watched in the not-too-distant past that for one reason or another you think are worth mentioning. So let's get started. Which of these three titles do you want to talk about first?
Well, one of the ones that I really liked was on Netflix called The Evolution of Us. It's two episodes. They're about 45 minutes each. And it starts with when we were apes or monkeys, and what made the ape decide to stand up, because that began the whole Homo erectus change in us, which took many thousands of years. And it just shows, like, we all kind of know that humans started in Africa and why they moved from Africa and went to different climates, skin color change, losing the hair. And it's just such a great show. I recommend it so much. And they've learned so much about, with the discovery of the human genome, why certain races and certain cultures had different kind of strengths. And one thing I thought was so interesting in this, apparently back like in the 1500s, the Chinese army had about 1 million people in it. And the Jin dynasty from Mongolia had about 100,000. And they attacked the Chinese army and won. And now, because we can go into the skeletons of these ancient people and find out, apparently the Jinns drank their horse milk. They drank a lot of horse milk, and they brought no food into battle. Every horse they brought was either an extra horse in case one got injured, or just galloping along with no luggage, no food on it. Whereas the Chinese, even though they had a million man army, half their horses were loaded down with food. And this way, the Jinns would just drink all this horse milk. They were long and lean. They had great bones. They had great teeth. And that's why they were able to conquer the Chinese back in the day. And these two episodes are full of interesting facts like this, if you're interested in where we came from. And the second one is, where are we going? I highly recommend them.
How long are they?
About 45 minutes each.
And what do you think makes them particularly, the trivia and the information that you just cited is interesting, of course, but what do you think makes them compelling as a piece of entertainment that somebody could watch?
Well, I think that everything that they cover, we've all thought about and wondered, and it's very clear, and it's just, you don't have to be a scientific person or a medical person to appreciate it. And, they even talked about, what else did they say? I wrote something down here. Oh, about natural selection. This was an interesting thing they said, that every single human being is born with 35 to 50 mutations. And over thousands of years, these will make us stronger and make us better able to survive and future generations. I thought that was interesting that we're all born with 35 to 50 mutations. And it won't really affect, most of them won't affect us now, but they'll affect right. us later.
And affect us in positive ways.
What, honey?
And affect us in positive ways, it sounds like, is what it's suggesting. Huh.
Okay.
So that's right. one of my recommendations.
And that's on Netflix right now.
Netflix right now.
Okay, because not all of these, as you've pointed out, I did title this segment Mama Sue's Netflix Recs. These are not all on Netflix. We're just kind of enjoying the poetic nature of that title. These are just streamable shows online in one place or another. So maybe let's go to one that's not on Netflix next.
All right, well, the other one that I watched, and actually I had to be convinced to watch it by Natalie's parents, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And actually, comedy is my least favorite thing to watch or read about.
Why?
I don't find a lot of things funny that other people find funny. So it's not my first choice, second choice, or third choice to watch anything that's considered funny.
Okay. Well, that's good background.
So from the first 10 minutes that I watched this by myself, I was hysterical laughing out loud.
Why?
It takes place in the 1950s, and it sounds very blah. I mean, the premise is, in the 50s, this young lady, her husband wants to be a comedian. She's so supportive. I mean, I'm not really giving it away because you find this out very early on. So he doesn't make it, and she decides she wants to be a comedian. So, and it's all about her family, her parents, her manager. Everyone is funnier than the rest, and it's just so well done. It's two seasons, 8 to 10 episodes per season. I watched both seasons from morning to late at night, straight through.
Over how many days?
One.
You got through both seasons in one day?
Yes, I did.
Wow, that's impressive.
I didn't get anything done that day, as you can imagine.
Of course you didn't.
I said, one more episode. I'll watch one more episode. No, this is the next one. This is the last episode I'm watching. I couldn't pull myself away from it. It was great.
It has gotten 30 wins, award wins, and 42 nominations in 2018. It won for Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress, Outstanding Supporting Actress, Outstanding Directing, Outstanding Writing, Outstanding Casting, Outstanding Single Camera Picture Editing for a Comedy, Outstanding Music Supervision. And it was nominated for a bunch more. Is there any particular...
It deserves every one of them.
So you said, you know, each performance is better than the next. Is there a particular character that you find just like tickles you more than the others, or you're just like happy when that person's in a scene?
Well, I mean, the two characters I liked most was Mrs. Maisel. I forget what her first name is in the movie and in the show, and Susie, her manager. I love their dynamic. I mean, her parents were great. I mean, everyone was great. I can't say that anybody didn't add to it.
You know, we had Susie's played by Alex Borstein, who is a member of the bleeding disorders community, and she's been on this podcast before. Maybe you should go check out that interview. You might enjoy it.
I didn't even know that. She's amazing. She's the best.
Yeah, she's really, really funny. And we did a play in New York with Rachel Brosnahan back in the day before she was the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which has nothing to do with her success and nothing. Just one of those things you say when somebody you know has a lot of success. You go, oh, I did something with them once. You know, it makes you feel better about yourself. All right. Well, wow. I can't believe you got through both seasons. That's 18 episodes in one day. That's a feat.
Well, you know, I get up very early, even on my days off, just from habit. I get up early. So, you know, I watched a lot of TV that day, but I loved it. What can I say?
And that one's on Amazon, right?
That one's on Amazon, yes.
Okay, so we got The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel from a big recommendation from someone who admittedly does not generally enjoy comedy, outside of Stop the Bleeding, of course, and The Evolution of Us on Netflix for those interested in documentaries, human history. So what's our third choice?
Okay, our third choice is one I watched very recently, also on Amazon, called The Making of the Mob New York, narrated by Ray Liotta. I'm very fascinated by the mob. I always have been. And of course, we've all seen Goodfellas and different ones along the way. I like this so much because it started like in the early 1920s when Charlie Luciano and Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky were just street kids on the Lower East Side, and it showed how it all evolved, went all the way up to 1961. The acting also was very good. I didn't really know any of the actors before, although maybe I've seen them along the way. It was very clear, and I just couldn't help but think when I watched it, is if these people had been on the right side of the law, they would have been so successful. Because they especially Luciano and Rothstein, I forget Rothstein's first name, Carl, I think. He tried to teach Luciano how to run it like a business and have a board of directors, which kind of evolved into that Five Families thing. And I just thought it was fantastic and very interesting. So that leaves off at 1961.
And why does it leave off there, do you think? What's significant about that year?
I don't know. The last episode was showing Gambino, who had not really been mentioned up till that point. He was kind of in the background. Gambino was against Luciano, and Vito Genovese was kind of going over to Gambino. So I guess if there'll be another season, there was just one season of this, six or seven episodes. If there'll be another season, I imagine they'll pick up from 61.
Well, I have some good news for you. It actually looks like there are two seasons. There's one on Making of the Mob New York, the one you're describing, and then there's the Making of the Mob Chicago.
That's great. Is that on right now?
Maybe. I'll keep clicking around here. But yeah, there's two seasons that are available, 16 episodes in total.
Yeah, they touch upon Chicago. They touch upon Las Vegas. And of course, even though Maya Lansky and Bugsy Siegel had been his childhood friends, they couldn't be in the proper mob because they weren't Italian. But they were, especially Lansky was his best friend and his advisor. He's the only one that lived to be in old age, Lansky, because he wasn't really in it. He was in it, but he was more of an advisor.
You might also enjoy Boardwalk Empire. We were talking about that off mic a little bit, the HBO show that was made by some of the people from The Sopranos with Steve Buscemi, because it looks at Prohibition and how Prohibition really gave rise to a lot of organized crime.
Yes, I should look at that also. That'll be this weekend. I'm going to be snowed in anyway, so I'll be watching a lot of TV.
Is that the forecast for New York this weekend, a lot of snow?
No. Supposedly, we're going to get a big storm Saturday and Sunday. We'll see.
Ugh, okay. Well, you don't have anywhere that you have to go or anything. You have to worry about digging the car out or anything like that?
No, my plan is to just hunker down. Yeah, not to do anything outside the house. I'll just read my books and watch my TV.
Well, now you have a podcast segment that you have to prepare for. So watching your TV is actually doing homework for you. So now it's like work.
Well, I tried to pick three very different genres to talk about. So I hope that, everybody, likes the ones I recommended.
So we have The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, The Evolution of Us, and The Making of the Mob. Yeah, three very different shows here recommended by Mama Sue on Suzy Q's Netflix Rex. That was the alternative title that I was thinking of. It just slipped out. Mama Sue's Netflix Rex is the title that we decided to go with. All right, well, this is good. I like hearing these recommendations. What do you have anything that you're looking forward to watching or anything that you might be that's on your queue that we might hear about from you next month?
Well, I did start watching one called Bramwell. So that's about a lady doctor in the late 1800s. And of course, that was before medicine was as refined as it is today. And of course, being that she's a lady, she was not given a lot of opportunities to practice. I started watching it, and I'm going to watch a couple of seasons in the next few weeks. So I hope to talk about that.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to hearing about Bramwell next time. Well, thanks for doing this, Mom. This was a lot of fun.
You're welcome.
Parting shots. One last thing to leave the audience with, bleeding disorders related or otherwise, before we say so long, farewell, and we'll see you in February. Natalie Lynch, your parting shot for January 2019.
Well, your comment segment.
Wow, that was a really suspenseful, okay.
Made me think of something we're talking about later in life diagnosis.
Yeah.
So last month I was diagnosed with something.
Oh, that's true.
And I don't really believe it's true, actually.
It feels like such a bigger thing than parting shots, but okay.
Well, we went to the allergist.
Do you want to tell them what? Okay, go ahead.
I was diagnosed with asthma, and she assumes that I've had it my whole life.
Yeah.
And I don't believe it's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm on some breathing treatments, mm-hmm. and I'm going to go back. But I just think I had a bad cold, and I have acute chronic bronchitis that she thinks is asthma. But
have you been diagnosed with acute chronic bronchitis?
No, outside of me diagnosing myself, no, that I haven't.
So so you've been misdiagnosed, you think, with asthma when I your think, correct diagnosis, you think, again, Dr. Natalie here.
Right. But if this diagnosis is correct, then I've had asthma my whole life and I never even knew it.
I mean, I'd ask you how you feel about that, except I feel like you first have to...
accept the diagnosis?
Yeah.
Well... yeah, and maybe my denying it is how I feel about it. But I don't want to have this thing.
It could be. I mean, it's entirely possible.
But you know, I do get these chronic coughs that last months on end in the winter.
This is true.
But then they go away. So like, I don't think asthma goes away, and I don't think she understood that. But anyways, I'm not questioning the medical community.
No, you. Well, you're questioning a member of it.
But
publicly.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it just made me think of my later in life diagnosis.
All right, well, do us a favor. Circle back to this next month. Let us know. This is good. It's an advocacy. It's a self-advocacy thing. So you're going to go back to the allergist. You're going to dig a little deeper.
I'm going to question the diagnosis because I have some questions about it.
Good.
And I'm doing the treatments.
Right.
And I'm feeling medium.
Uh-huh.
But I'm a little skeptical.
Okay, well, fair enough. Very good. Keep us posted.
I will.
Keep us posted.
And what's your parting shot for January 2019?
Well, my parting shot for January 2019 is that I upped my mental health game and amongst other things, I have started to see a psychiatrist. And as part of seeing the psychiatrist and enjoying some downtime in December, I went back and decided to revisit my favorite television show of all time, which is The Sopranos, which is the major conceit of which is built around this head mobster going to see a psychiatrist. I am now almost done with all six seasons of The Sopranos again. And I have to say, 20 years later, it's the 20th anniversary, it holds up so well. It is such a good show. If you like comedy, if you like drama, if you like good writing, if you like good acting, if you like good cinematography, and there's themes to the show that you would swear it was written just a year or two ago, and they are making a movie about the origin stories of The Sopranos where they go back to...
young Tony, right?
No, his dad. They go to his dad and sort of like, you know, the whole show opens with like, oh, it's on the downfall. Like the glory days of the New Jersey mob are over. So evidently this movie is going to kind of go back to those glory days. There's also a book that famed critic, television critic Alan Sepinwall has written that I have ordered on Amazon.
I saw the email receipt.
Yeah, figured you knew who ordered that. It was a lot of fun to revisit that. The show holds up incredibly well. If you haven't seen it, if you enjoy entertainment and you haven't seen The Sopranos, stop making a mistake. And also, it was very fun to watch a show that weaves throughout it psychotherapy in well-informed, interesting, and creative ways. It's a drama television show. Like, it's not, its job is not to be a medically accurate depiction of every aspect of mental health, but it actually does a really interesting job of exploring all these themes, both within and outside of the therapist's office. So that's kind of been fun, given where I am currently, to pay particular attention to. And that is my parting shot. What do you think?
I thought it was great. Let's clarify, you are not going to the psychiatrist because you started watching The Sopranos again.
No, I started watching The Sopranos again because I started going to the psychiatrist.
Okay.
Yeah, they're absolutely related, but there's an answer to my chicken or egg.
Well, thank you very much, and I think that's a great parting shot.
Well, you know, thank you very much, and hey, that is all for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, and our sponsor...
Shire.
Thanks as well to Clive Smith and the UK Hemophilia Society, spelt in a way Natalie hates, for contributing this month's Share segment, and to Amy Board for being our interview guest. I wrote this mother's Share segment because my mother is now appearing on the podcast, so that was a little non-Freudian slip, but I don't know, whatever that is.
I mean,
there.
Kind of Freudian.
Maybe it's Freudian, who knows? We're not going there. Subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast, the Ask the Expert Podcast, the Powering Through Podcast, and the Bloodline special series of podcasts. We've got a good one coming up soon on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name remains Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.
Shire, it's great.